I am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War, in his essay entitled We Got Slapped. We pick up the story with a summary of Johnson's pre-presidential career as a congressman and his volunteer to fight in World War II and his assignment as a Navy observer in the Pacific Zone. President Roosevelt had Lyndon Johnson dispatched as a Navy observer to study the beleaguered Allied effort in the combat zone of Australia. The congressman left the management of his house office to Lady Bird Johnson, his wife. In June 1942, after a briefing by General Douglas MacArthur in Melbourne, Australia, Lieutenant Commander Johnson and two other observers who were vetting air and ground forces were flown to Garbutt Field, the launching base for aerial attacks against the Japanese in New Guinea. Johnson was to fly on a B-26 Marauder called the Wabash Cannonball, but his place was taken at the last moment by Lieutenant Colonel Francis Stevens, one of his fellow Navy observers. So he walked across the airstrip and asked the commander of another B-26 called the Heckling Hare if he could fly with his crew. The Hare's tail gunner, Corporal Harry Barron, warned Johnson that it would be rough and that he might get shot up. By Johnson's later account, an hour after takeoff, Japanese Zero fighter planes swarmed all around the Heckling Hare, which was struck by bullets and cannon shells, damaging the generator that drove the plane's right engine. Descending the barrage, the Hare's radio gunman, Lilius Walker, later said, "You're looking right into the face of death when that happens." According to Walker, Congressman Johnson was calm and watched everything. When the Heckling Hare sat down, Johnson smiled and told the crew, "It's been very interesting." Soon he was told the Wabash Cannonball, the plane he was supposed to fly on, was under attack and had crashed into the ocean with no survivors. Upon Lyndon Johnson's return to Melbourne, Australia, Douglas MacArthur presented him with a Silver Star, the Army's third highest medal, but gave nothing to the actual Heckling Hare crewmen who were risking their lives all the time. One of Johnson's biographers, Robert Carroll, called the award one of the most undeserved Silver Stars in history, noting that if you accept everything that he said, he was still in action for no more than 13 minutes and only as an observer. Another historian, Robert Dallach, concluded that Johnson had made a deal by which General MacArthur would give him the medal if Lyndon Johnson pledged to push the president to expand resources for his South Pacific theater. In July 1942, Johnson returned to Washington when Franklin Roosevelt ordered that all members of Congress then serving in the armed forces either resign or return. Back in harness, Johnson was at first modest about the episode that had brought him the Silver Star, telling his friend Marshall McNeil, a Texas journalist, "Well, I've never wear the thing." He even wrote a letter, ultimately unsent, saying that, in good conscience, he could not accept a citation for the little part I played for such a short time. But before long, he was insisting that his record aboard the Heckling Hare deserved an even more glorious reward than a Silver Star. As president, Johnson did not mind preening about his wartime bravery. In December 1963, while referring to political courage, he told U.S. House Speaker John McCormick, "I didn't want to go to the Pacific in 1941 after Pearl Harbor, but I did, and I didn't want to let those Japs shoot at me in a zero, but I did." In November 1948, Johnson was elected to the United States Senate by the 87-vote margin that earned him the derisive nickname Landslide Lyndon. 2 years later, after the Korean War began, outraged by Robert Taft's complaint that Truman had usurped congressional power, Lyndon Johnson sent the president a note expressing his admiration of his courageous response, adding, "For the decisions you must face alone, you have my most sincere prayers and my total confidence." Later, President Truman would tell Lyndon Johnson, with some exaggeration, "I remember you were the first senator to support me." Lyndon Johnson recalled how President Truman had been chair of the Senate committee investigating the defense effort in World War II, warning that if Republicans retook Congress that November, scrutiny of Truman's war might fall dangerously to the panel chaired by Senator Joe McCarthy. He persuaded his mentor, Richard Russell of Georgia, chairman of Senate Armed Services, known as Mr. Defense, to give him control of a new subcommittee on war expenditures, which elevated Johnson's stature. After Republicans took control of the Senate in 1952, Richard Russell helped him become minority leader of the Senate and then majority leader after the Democratic comeback 2 years later in 1954. In that capacity, Lyndon Johnson collaborated with President Eisenhower and another mentor, Speaker Sam Rayburn of Texas, on what they called a bipartisan foreign policy. The trio banded together against the Vestigo isolationist bloc, mostly Republicans, who were touting a possible constitutional amendment proposed by Senator John Bricker, Republican of Ohio, that would severely limit a president's power to make executive agreements with other countries. President Eisenhower made Johnson feel like a co-pilot, a charmed experience that may later have given him illusions as president about how much congressional cooperation he could expect on national security. During Johnson's miserable years as John Kennedy's vice president, he did not feel like a co-pilot of anything. Well acquainted from the Senate with Johnson's talent for agglomerating power, JFK kept him on a short leash. Johnson later claimed that Kennedy had told the Catholics, meaning the president's co-religious John McCormick and Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, to pay no attention to me. Before Kennedy's inauguration, Johnson had asked Senate Democrats to let him keep presiding over their caucus. They rebuffed him, citing the constitutional separation of powers, and Kennedy observed that the steam really went out of Lyndon. When Kennedy called on Johnson for comment during councils on foreign policy, Vice President Johnson would sometimes lower his head and sadly reply that he was insufficiently informed to suffer an opinion. Throughout the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 8, 1962, Johnson was a member of Robert Kennedy's impromptu advisory panel called XCOM. Attorney General Robert Kennedy observed that when his brother refused the Joint Chiefs' demand that the missile sites be bombed, followed by an invasion of the island, Lyndon Johnson was shaking his head mad, although he never made clear what he would do instead. After Nikita Khrushchev, Premier of Russia, agreed to pull the missiles out, however, Johnson grudgingly conceded to a friend that the president had played a damn good hand of poker. I'll say that for him. In November 1963, 3 weeks before John F. Kennedy's assassination, the increasingly detested and authoritarian president of South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, and his powerful brother were killed after a coup that Kennedy had approved. During a Saigon goodwill visit, Johnson had hailed Diem in 1961 as the George Washington of Southeast Asia. He thought it was a mistake for John Kennedy to have expected Diem to reform his political system and make Vietnam into an America overnight. After Johnson became president, he privately said that Diem's ouster and killing had been a tragic mistake. "It was awful, and we've lost everything." Robert Kennedy was infuriated to learn that Johnson was privately saying that his brother's assassination may have been divine retribution for his role in the coup that led to Diem's murder. On Saturday, December 7, 1963, upon Jacqueline Kennedy's departure, Lyndon Johnson moved his family into the White House, with Lady Bird Johnson holding a large framed photograph of Speaker Rayburn and teenage daughters Linda and Lucy. She later changed her name to Lucy with an I, handling the family beagles, him and her. That same day, the president telephoned Senator Richard Russell. On becoming president, Johnson had told the Georgia senator, "I haven't got any daddy, and you're going to be it." Now in command of the White House indoor pool, he asked his friend, "You don't feel like coming down here and going swimming? This good warm water?" Suffering from emphysema, Senator Russell declined, explaining, "I've got this short-winded business. I can't breathe." Johnson brought up Vietnam. Russell advised him, "We should get out, but I don't know any way to get out." Russell reminded Johnson of their meeting with President Eisenhower in April 1954 when the French colonists were collapsing at Dien Bien Phu. Ike had asked for the discretionary authority to use U.S. air and sea power against communist aggression in Southeast Asia. But Johnson and Senator Russell had balked, advising Eisenhower that America should not act alone there. As the Georgia senator now reminded the new president, "I tried my best to keep them from going into Laos and Vietnam. Said we would never get out, be in there 50 years from now." In January 1964, General Dong Van Binh Minh, who had succeeded Diem as leader of South Vietnam, was deposed in Saigon by a junta commanded by the 36-year-old General Ninh Quan. Undersecretary of State George Ball told Johnson that Quan's assent was probably a good thing. Soon Johnson called Quan the toughest one they got, and he asked his Joint Chiefs of Staff to proclaim that he was our boy. Quan demanded that Americans save South Vietnam by attacking North Vietnam. U.S. officials asked him to wait until his government was better established. Quan warned that by then it would be too late. Dean Rusk reminded Johnson that the Manila Pact, signed by the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization known as CETO in 1954, committed the United States to South Vietnam's defense. The Joint Chiefs advised him in March that preventing the loss of South Vietnam was of overriding importance to the United States. The CIA warned Johnson in May that if the tide of deterioration were not halted by the end of 1964, the anti-communist position in South Vietnam is likely to become untenable. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara told Johnson's National Security Council that same month, "The situation is still going to hell. Nothing we are now doing will win. The question is whether we should hit North Vietnam now or whether we can wait." Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, McNamara, Secretary of Defense, and McBundy all beseeched Johnson to make a presidential decision that the U.S. will use selected and carefully graduated military force against North Vietnam. Seeking advice on Wednesday morning, May 27th, Lyndon Johnson called Senator Russell, who told him, stating, "It's the damn worst mess I ever saw, and I don't see how we're going to get out of it without fighting a major war with the Chinese and all of them down there in those rice paddies and jungles. It appears that our position is deteriorating, and it looks like the more that we try to do for them, the less that they're willing to do for themselves. It's just one of those places where you can't win. It frightens me. It would be a Korea on a much bigger scale and a worse scale. The French report that they lost 250,000 men and spent a couple billion of their money and 2 billion of ours down there and just got the hell whipped out of them. We're just in the quicksands, up to our very necks." Senator Russell recommended that Johnson engineer a fresh coup, this time against Khan, stating, "Get some fellow in there that said he wished to hell we would get out. That would give us a good excuse for getting out." Johnson asked Senator Russell how important South Vietnam was to American security. The senator replied that with America's fast-growing arsenal of nuclear-tipped intercontinental missiles, Vietnam isn't important to us a damn bit, except from a psychological standpoint. Johnson reported to Senator Russell that his chief advisors were telling him that "we haven't got much choice, that we are treaty-bound, that this will be a dynamo that will kick off a whole list of others, that we've just got to prepare for the worst." He said that they sounded kind of like MacArthur in Korea. They don't believe that the Chinese communists will come into this thing, but they don't know, and nobody can really be sure. Then showing his ambivalence, Johnson asked, "They would impeach a president, though, that would run out, wouldn't they?" Russell warned him that if Johnson sent combat troops to Vietnam, it'll be the most expensive venture this country ever went into. The president cited that little old sergeant who had laid out his clothes in the mornings, stating, "Every time I think about making this decision, I think about sending that father of those six kids in there. And what the hell are we going to get out of this doing that? It just makes the chills run up my back." Senator Russell agreed, "It does me." Johnson said, "I haven't the nerve to do it, but I don't see any other way out of it." Russell said, "It doesn't make much sense to do it. It's one of those things, heads I win, tails you lose." The president closed, "I love you, and I'll be calling you." Then Johnson telephoned Mac Bundy, confiding, "The more that I stay awake last night thinking of this thing, it looks to me like we're getting into another Korea. I believe that the Chinese communists are coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think that we can get out." Plaintively, he asked, "What the hell is Vietnam worth to me? What is it worth to this country? No, we've got a treaty, but hell, everybody else has got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it. Of course, you can start running from the communists. They may just chase you right into your own kitchen." Bundy replied, "That's the trouble." Johnson cited a poll showing that 65% of Americans don't know anything about Vietnam, and of those that do, the majority think we're mishandling it. But they don't know what to do. He warned, "It's damn easy to get into a war, but it's going to be awfully hard to ever extricate yourself if you get in." With Johnson eager to be elected president in his own right in 1964, Vietnam was gaining more prominence in the campaign. That month, Barry Goldwater blamed the Vietnam stalemate on Johnson and McNamara, those twin commanders of chaos. He claimed that low-yield nuclear weapons could be used to defoliate the South Vietnamese border, depriving Viet Cong rebels of cover, explaining that a defensive war is never won. Senator Everett Dirksen and Charles Halleck, Republican leaders of the Senate and House, soon learned that Vietnam would be an issue because President Johnson's indecision has made it one. Denouncing Johnson's contradictions, confusion, and vacillation, Halleck charged that the president was avoiding a decision until after the election, while we go on dribbling away both American lives and American prestige in a no-win war. On Wednesday evening, June 10, 1964, Johnson's close boyhood friend and Hill Country business partner, A.W. Morsund, admonished him, "God damn, there's not anything that will destroy you as quick as pulling out, pulling up stakes, and running." The president replied, "But I don't want to kill these folks." Morsund, a World War II Army Air Corps veteran, said, "I don't give a damn. I don't want to kill them in Korea." Morsund told him to stand up for America, warning, "They'll forgive you for anything except being weak." The next day at noon, nervous about Morrison's advice, Johnson called Senator Russell, sounding notably more hawkish about Vietnam, stating, "I don't believe the American people ever want me to run away. If I lose it, I think they'll say, I've lost it. I've pulled in. At the same time, I don't want to commit us to a war, and I'm in a hell of a shape." With astonishing foresight, Russell warned, "It would take 500,000 men. They'll be bogged down there for 10 years. But Johnson said, "We never did clear Korea up." Russell replied, "Except for 70,000 of them buried over there." Russell went on to say, "I don't know what the hell to do. I did never want to get messed up down there. But as a practical matter, we're in there, and I don't know how the hell you can tell the American people you're coming out. They'll think that you've just been whipped. You've just been ruined. You're scared. It would be disastrous." Johnson replied, "I think they've got to say that I didn't get you in here, but we're in here by treaty, and our national honors at stake. After dinner at the White House on Monday, June 15th, the president took his friends Clark Clifford, one of Truman's White House counsel, and the belligerent Washington Post columnist Joseph Alsop aside to discuss Vietnam. Alsop warned the president that he was in danger of presiding over the first real defeat of the United States in history. Lady Bird Johnson later told her diary that this conversation did nothing to solve Lyndon's dilemma or to smooth his path for the days ahead. The next morning, Johnson told McNamara, "I was with some folks last night, and they think we're about to lose the greatest race that the United States has ever lost, and it would be the first time we've ever turned a tail and then shoved out of a place and come home and said we've given up the Pacific. Now, I don't think it's that bad, but a lot of people do, and I think we're going to have to make a decision pretty promptly." Secretary of Defense McNamara replied, "I just don't believe we can be pushed out of there, Mr. President. We just can't allow it to be done." He added that you wouldn't want to go down in history that way. Senator Russell had earlier warned the president that the Secretary of Defense was as opinionated as hell, and he's made up his mind on this. Johnson was trying to hold the line on Vietnam until November 1964, postponing his toughest choices until he did not have to operate within the unpredictable madhouse atmosphere of a presidential campaign. By now, he had discarded Russell's advice to engineer Khan's downfall in South Vietnam and install a South Vietnamese leader who would demand an American withdrawal. The senator had bluntly told Johnson to get the same crowd that got rid of old DM to get rid of these people. The president now believed that the greatest danger we face there now is losing Khan and being asked to get out. He warned Speaker McCormick that if Khan falls over, as he may any day, and we have another coup, we're through in Asia. Johnson thought negotiation would be fruitless. "Conferences ain't going to do a damn bit of good," he told Senator Russell. "We tell them every week. We tell Khrushchev of Russia. We send China and Hanoi and all of them word that we'll get out of there and stay out of there if they'll just quit raiding their neighbors. And they just say, screw you." At the end of June, speaking in Minneapolis, the president assured Americans that he would use force when necessary and risk war to protect South Vietnam. White House aides have been working since May to draft a congressional resolution endorsing all measures, including the commitment of force, to defend the existing regimes in Laos and South Vietnam. Johnson told them that President Truman had erred in failing to ask Congress for approval to wage his war in Korea. His aide Jack Valente later observed that had some president tried to do so when Johnson was Senate leader, Johnson would have torn his balls off. Only if Congress was in on the takeoff would it take responsibility for any crash landing in Vietnam. Johnson reminded Robert Kennedy, who was still his attorney general, that in the Korean War, we had the United Nations behind us, but we had a very divided country and a lot of hell, and we finally really lost. The Democrats did. He knew that House and Senate hearings on his Vietnam policy would be ferocious and damaging, especially during a presidential campaign. He told Robert Kennedy that he would shudder if members debated a resolution on Vietnam for a long period of time. "They would just talk and develop a big divide here at home," he said. Kennedy agreed, stating, "They'll start asking somebody to spell out what exactly is going to happen, and if we drop bombs there when they retaliate and we eventually bomb Hanoi." Johnson said, "That's all true, and you can't go into the details of your plans. But if you take the other route, then they ask you by what authority, what executive order do you declare war?" The attorney general was hoping that Johnson would choose him to run for vice president in 1964, so he was in no mood to quarrel. He advised the president that a congressional resolution was probably not constitutionally necessary, but that in its absence, should Johnson wish to use major force in Vietnam, he had better brief House and Senate leaders beforehand. Johnson agreed, stating, and I think probably talk to the country about why we are there. Secretary of Defense McNamara advised him that June not to ask for any resolution unless he planned to send combat forces to Vietnam within the next 2 or 3 months, stating, "If we're going to go strictly up the escalating chain, we're going to have to educate the people, Mr. President. We haven't done so yet." McBundy counseled that in the meantime, public support for military action would be strengthened by a substantial increase of national attention and international tension. On Monday, August 3, 1964, at 10:20 in the morning, the day after the North Vietnamese attack on the destroyer Matic in the Tonkin Gulf, President Johnson asked Dean Rusk, his Secretary of State, and Robert McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, to meet privately with Senate and House leaders and tell them what happened in the Tonkin Gulf. "They're going to start an investigation if you don't. It would be better to do it up on the hill. I'll tell them to be awfully quiet, though, so they won't go in and be making a bunch of speeches." The Secretary of Defense urged that the leaders be told about the secret OPLAN-34A plan, since there is no question that it had bearing on the attack. He reminded the president that on Friday night, we had 4 PT boats from Vietnam, manned by Vietnamese or other nationals, attack 2 islands, and that the adversary had undoubtedly connected the assault with the presence of the destroyer Maddox. Johnson consented. He asked McNamara to leave an impression on background that were going to be firm as hell. He reported that the people that are calling me up were saying that the Navy responded wonderfully and that's good, but they want to be damn sure I don't pull them out and run. That's what all the country wants, because Barry Goldwater is raising so much hell about how he's going to blow them off the moon. Reading in Michael Beschloss's Presence of War and his essay on Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.